It's little wonder that America is losing on every front, that the nation is in a death spiral. We have nincompoops like U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Victoria Nuland saying that Western sanctions are working against Russia. Yes, first she claims that the ruble has been devalued against the dollar by 20%, not recognizing that that's against American interests. When our currency rises in value above a foreign currency, it means that, A, Americans can go now and tour Russia, while Russian tourists can't come and tour America because of the exchange rate. It means that a tractor made by John Deere or a bulldozer made by Caterpillar or a jet airplane made by Boeing is now not affordable in Russia, which means that America loses jobs. But those products that are made in Russia are available in the United States, and now they have a 20% discount that they didn't previously have. Go ahead, Glenn.
But no, I'd say just imagine what a great deal you'd be able to get on an AKs.
Oh, yeah. So, but you know what? You know who the largest manufacturer of AK-47s is?
Colt.
Yeah, America. We manufacture more AK-47s than does Russia, and we manufacture them because we give them to the various policing and terrorist organizations around the world that we use as proxies, and the guns are much more appropriate to be operated by the thugs that we give them to than are the AR-15 assault rifles that America manufactures, which have much tighter tolerances and thus aren't nearly as reliable. You know, if you have one of each, go see what happens if you drop both of them in the sand or drop both of them in a muddy pond and then try to fire them. Or
they supposedly fixed a lot of that, you know, during the Vietnam era. But yeah, if you want to aim, you're better off with the M16. But if you want to aim carefully, you know.
Yes. Although to be perfectly frank, if aim is your purpose, you do not shoot an automatic rifle like an assault rifle. If aim is your purpose, they have rifles that are specifically made that are ideal for that, and and the caliber of all of these assault rifles is not such that they are useful.
For sniping, I understand. Within a couple hundred yards or, you know, 5,100 yards or something But I certainly wasn't talking about a Marine sniper within 30 or 50 or something like that. I did want to say I banished the image from my mind of Cleavon Little from Blazing Saddles with his own gun to his own head, change the dub in the face of Obama and caption it, "One more move and I'll sanction you."
Yeah, it's truly astonishing. You know, going beyond the fact that our dollar, which is worthless essentially, is more valuable than the ruble on international markets, making their products more affordable in the United States and precluding the sale of American products in Russia. She went on to say that the Russian bond rating in recent months is just above junk. But the fact of the matter is, the Russians have a national surplus. I mean, the fact that America's bonds, treasury bills, would be junk right now if it wasn't for the illusion of quantitative easing. I mean, the only reason America's treasuries aren't junk now is because of quantitative easing. Rather than, we found it impossible to continue to sell our treasuries on an international market. China doesn't want them anymore. Japan doesn't want them anymore. Saudi Arabia doesn't want it. Nobody wants them. And because no one will buy our treasuries on an international market, the only way for us to sell them was twofold. One is we forced any bank doing transactions in America to have holdings in America in treasuries. And we just passed rules that said, you either do that or you can't do business in the United States. And then the second thing we did is we came up with quantitative easing, which is the illusion of loans, where we're creating the illusion of money to provide the money for the loans called quantitative easing. Otherwise, our credit rating would be junk, and we are desperate for funds, and Russia's doesn't need them. Russia has a national surplus. The next thing that she said is that the IMF is about to declare that Russia's on the verge of a recession. Well, first of all, the IMF isn't an unbiased agency. The IMF is the economic manipulator of the United States and Western Europe. The IMF is the
tigers of the world.
Oh, of course. The IMF is an interesting player in the Ukraine situation because the IMF did not want to give loans to the Ukraine without the Ukraine having to provide absolute guarantees and assurances that this time the loans would be paid back and they wouldn't welch on the terms. And then Russia came in and said, listen, because we have Skiffygate, we'll provide you with this first $15 billion worth of debt that'll get you through at least this year. And the IMF had a conniption fit. So the IMF is a hurt dog in this. Now, the IMF did get the loans, but it was because Europe and the United States backed the loans. And so the IMF is not a reasonable evaluator.
But no, there's waivers. There's waivers.
Of course, it's one of the worst organizations in the world. Now, beyond all of that, let's say that the United States actions would be considered good because they imposed a recession on the United States. A recession in one of the largest economies in the world. How's that going to influence the United States?
It's not going to help.
It's going to hurt. It's going to hurt.
Slow the economy. You know.
Absolutely. But also, what happens when, let's just say that it's a terrible downturn and that there's a depression in Russia. What do national leaders do when their economy has been devastated by a foreign foe?
They kill people and destroy things.
That's right. They blame that foreign foe for the people's conditions, and the people then, in their righteous indignation, want to lash out at that foe, and they kill people and they break things. That's what happens. So if you push people into that position, all you get is a bad situation. So here's the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, that hasn't got a clue as to why what she's saying is actually counterproductive for the United States. I mean, just utterly clueless. Now, it's an interesting comment then was made by Chancellor Angela Merkel. Now, Merkel's in a really interesting position here. Merkel really wants, they're dancing between raindrops. First of all, Germany does a lot of business with Russia. Russia does a lot of business with Germany. The primary trade is that Russia supplies gas, Germany supplies manufactured goods. But they do a lot of business together, huge trading partners. And so Germany can't push this too far, but it certainly wanted to play along with the United States and to have the Ukraine fall under Western Europe, which means under Germanic control. So this is Chancellor Merkel speaking in Berlin. She said, the more representatives at these talks, now this was about a conference that Russia was going to have. She says, clearly, people are only welcome to this economic summit if they can credibly show that they are prepared to reach their goals without violence. So she's saying that we'll partner with people who reach their goals without violence. Can you name, Glenn, in recent history, a less violent transition of control and the realization of the goals of the majority of the people than Crimea's exit from the Ukraine and amalgamation back into Russia?
No, I can't. But don't you know the vote thing was fraudulent? I mean, and if anybody knows vote fraud, it ought to be Americans right now. We know vote fraud. We engineer it, and that's what it was all fraudulent. So were the referenda.
But let's just pretend that there was vote fraud, and that really 97% of the Crimeans didn't want to secede from the Ukraine and join the Russia. Let's just pretend that it wasn't. Let's just say vote fraud, and it was really only 70% as opposed to 97%.
Right. That's still pretty overwhelming.
Still, can you imagine a less violent, more orderly, more humane transfer of control than what we witnessed in Crimea? The entire world ought to be applauding that and saying, oh, my goodness. That's the epitome of doing things without violence. In the eastern regions, which are no longer being called the Ukraine, they have Lukston, I think, is the name they're using, but which is the old existing territorial name for it. There, if it wasn't for the fact that the acting government out of Kiev sent in their army to suppress the protesters, it would be peaceful there. The biggest issues are really is when the Ukrainian pro-Ukrainians burned the 46 people alive in that in the building.
You know, to solve the rest of it, they could just repeat the Pakistan-India scenario of 54, whatever it was when they created Pakistan. Just draw a line and says, okay, everybody pro-Ukrainian on this side of the line, everybody pro-Russian on that side of the line, everybody migrate to the appropriate side of the line, and boom, we have Pakistan, India all over again.
Yeah, they actually have such a thing in Ukraine. It's a river, and I've forgotten the name of the river. I remember when I was really looking this up. And what you do is if you look at this, where the river runs through north to south through the Ukraine, cutting through the dividing three-quarters of the Ukraine to the west from one-quarter of the Ukraine to the east on a north and south, and it runs due north and south, that with exception of Odessa, which I think is just west of that river is the dividing line. Now Odessa wants to be part of Russia,
right.
And
right.
Doesn't want it. But if the river is the dividing line, you've resolved the problem.
Right.
And then let the West have the dependent of the western Ukraine and have the East go back into to Russia and the South go back into Russia. The only issue then is how do we work out, hey, why does the IMF, the United States, want to fund these people? We're already bankrupt. And B, how do you deal with the gas and oil through those pipelines that flow through northwestern Ukraine? We're talking about Kiev and the issues there. This particular article that came out today speaks of what's happening in the Ukrainian parliament. Now, mind you, the Ukrainian parliament is meeting, but they've had to meet without effectively implementing their constitution. It's an unconstitutional body at the moment. But Kiev's handling of the crisis in the east is causing the crazy scenes in the Ukrainian parliament. Today, for example, deputies and of the former ruling Regions Party, the Regions Party was the party that had won virtually every election, and their allies attacked the government for sending in the army, a move they said did nothing but alienate the Russian speakers. Now, you know what country told the Ukraine to send in the army to the east to suppress the Russian-speaking ethnic Russian protesters?
Probably the U.S.
That is correct. We not only told them to do it, we gave them the funds to do it. It was done. And do you think that the United States, at the time that the United States told the government to do it, that we would back them, that we funded it, we came providing the funds. We even provide the CIA. The CIA went there to provide the reconnaissance and intelligence information and the weapons support. When we told them to do it, do you think that the CIA and the Obama administration officials that were there knew that this would provoke the pro-Russian protesters in the East, and therefore was either going to spark a civil war or was going to spark a response on behalf of Russia?
Well, of course they did. That's how you set a trap and provoke a proxy war. That's what you got to do.
That's what they did. That's absolutely correct. And so now so what's happening now is that the most popular political party in the Ukraine is telling the parliament in the Ukraine, you know, by taking this bait and in doing what the United States funded and requested, what you've created is a situation where you've got now a third of the country despising you. You've created an enemy. You know, for any country, if for any country, when you do that, I'm doing a history now of Rome's malfeasance, and every time that Rome would send its army in to suppress people who were protesting, looking for freedom and dignity, all Rome did was manufacture enemies, and then it. So Rome's goal in putting down the protest was to make the punishments so horrific for those that would dare show character and morality that they would think twice about doing it. Then most people would just go along as being serfs and being slaves to Roman authority because they were afraid of what would happen to them. And that's really what the U.S. has put the acting Ukrainian government in that position. The only way that they can now prevail is to be so draconian that the people in the East come to fear doing the right thing, standing up against them. And when you do that, your days are numbered. No nation, no institution can do that and survive it.
Well, it simultaneously destroys them and puts Putin in the situation where so many people are dying that he has to, if he doesn't go in with military force to assist them, he looks like a coward or a wimp or like he's serving his wealthy friends who've pressured him to make
every
the go away.
Every person in the Ukraine over the age of 20 is a Russian citizen. And he is going to, he is absolutely going to respond. And so when he responds, the United States is not in a position to go to war with Russia. No matter what Senator John McCown wants, the United States cannot go to war with Russia. It's impossible. And since America can't go to war with Russia, then what? And then the only way that American politicians can save face is to impose ever greater sanctions against Russia. But if they do that, then they're provoking a conflict, an economic war that Americans are going to lose. And the reason Americans are going to lose that economic war, yes, America's economy is much larger than the Russian economy. But the reason America will lose that economic war is that Russia is not in debt, and America is.
But they're going to try to vilify him in the court of public opinion through propaganda and try and get the international community and the UN to vilify him and make him look bad.
But what good is that? I mean, it's so America can impose its clout against Western Europe and get some nations in Western Europe to puppet and parrot America's rhetoric. But what does that get anyone? You know, I'm spend most of the commercial break reading news stories. And one of the news stories that I was reading was that sent to me by a friend, a listener to the program, says that 1 in 4 people around the world now are anti-Semitic, that they identify themselves as anti-Semites. The highest level of anti-Semitism anywhere in the world is found in the West Bank and Gaza. As you might imagine, The Muslims living there are stunningly anti-Semitic. Now, it was interesting. I went to the next country down, and this survey takes us to Western Europe as opposed to worldwide. Because if you were to survey Egypt, you'd find that Egypt is in the high 90s anti-Semitic. If you were to survey Syria, you'd find the same thing in the high 90s. If you were to survey Iraq, Iran, survey Saudi Arabia, any of the Islamic countries, you're going to find that because the Quran calls Jews apes and swine, and because the Quran says that it changed the faces on Jews, replacing their faces with their asses. And when the Quran says that you get bonus jihad points for killing Jews, that Muslims are universally anti-Semitic, and they are. So this particular survey goes and it talks about what countries in the West are anti-Semitic. And so the most overtly Christian country in the West, it's not actually Italy. Because there's been enough people that are disenfranchised with the Roman Catholic Church in Italy, so that it is no longer the most overtly religious country in the West. It happens to be Greece. And really is no difference between the Eastern Orthodox Church that grew out of Constantinople and Constantine, the Roman Catholic Church. But in Greece, politics and religion are intertwined. Greece is the second most, or is the most anti-Semitic country in the West. 69% of Greeks are anti-Semitic. The lowest percentage of anti-Semitism in any Western country happens to be in Sweden with 4%. 10% of Americans are anti-Semitic. Now, that is interesting. What's interesting about that is it can't be a consequence of the Islamic population, because the Islamic population of America is in less than half of 1%. And the overall Jewish population of America, while as large in numbers as the number of Jews that live in Israel, 84% of Jews worldwide live in Israel, the United States, split evenly between the two countries. But still, Jews only represent less than that. It's 6 million Jews on 300 million population, which would be, you know, approximately 5% of the population. And so it's extraordinarily, a fraction of that, one third of that. And so you have an extraordinarily small amount of Jews that live here, and yet they are the focus of anti-Semitism. I was speaking with Aaron during the break, and I said, you know, there is a direct link between conspiracy theorists and anti-Semites. Conspiracy theorists have this knee-jerk reaction of blaming Jews. They all refer to the protocols of the Eldons of Zion, which is a falsification. They will blame the Rothschilds, the Rothschilds are international bankers, so they're bad guys, but the fact they're Jewish is irrelevant. And they will blame the Jewish manipulation of the media and other things for the ills that they see in the world. Aaron admitted, yeah, there's a lot of that on other programs here. It's just stunning what people will believe in, and how anti-Semitic the world is, and remains, has become, continues to be. There are some myths that die very hard, and with 10% of Americans being anti-Semitic, we have a real problem here. I think that number is actually going to grow, too, because what's going to happen is that the consequence of America providing arms for the Sunni jihadists in the Syrian proxy war is that ultimately, according to Yahweh, that war ends with the Assyrian government failing, which means that war is going to go on for a very long time. Either that or it's going to die off and then be reborn again a third or fourth time down the road. And the jihadists that will have succeeded in their great jihad against the Syrian government are going to do exactly the same thing as what happened in Afghanistan. Where after the great jihad in Afghanistan, which was similarly inspired and funded by America, those jihadists, when they prevailed, didn't lay down their their tactics. They didn't set aside their religion. They didn't depart with their munitions. They just deployed them around the world. And so the embassy bombings in Africa, 9/11, the World Trade Center, both 1 and 2, the Islamic links to the Oklahoma City bombing, the train bombings in Spain and in England, all of those things materialized because the jihadists went back to their country and they continued to be jihadists. And it was a horrible time. You look at what happened in Russia when the jihadists went back to Russia. The Moscow theater bombings, the Beslan school massacres, all of the hospitals that were destroyed with the patients burned alive by Muslims. That's exactly what's going to happen. And as America endures more Islamic terrorism, because America has been so brainwashed and indoctrinated to disassociate Islam from terrorism, when the terrorists say that they're attacking America for its support of Israel, Americans are going to make that connection and going to become ever more anti-Semitic. So this is where we are headed, and I guess I'm also fascinated by the events of the Ukraine to bring all this back home to the Ukraine, because for non-Islamic countries, the Ukraine is the most anti-Semitic place on earth. And anti-Semitism is one of the three most telling signs of a society that is morally bankrupt. Sexual abuse of women, sexual abuse of children, and anti-Semitism are the canaries in the mine that will tell you when a society is deteriorating or has deteriorated. And when you see any one of the three becoming a meaningful percentage of the population, you know that that society has moved to the position that it's beyond hope. That's why the Islamic world with its female genital mutilation is beyond hope. It's why Roman Catholicism with its perverted abuse of little children and pedophilic priestly acts is beyond hope. And it's why the Ukraine and soon the United States will be beyond hope. Now, here's the United States embracing, funding, encouraging the most anti-Semitic nation outside of the Islamic world. Now, that tells us that either our leaders aren't thinking, either our leaders haven't done the research so that they know what they're doing, or they know what they're doing, and they're associating America with evil. Either way, this is a serious problem. Along the same lines as we speak about this, I read in the news earlier this week an amazing bit of hypocrisy. You know, the United States that had sent the Vice President of the United States to Kiev, that had sent the head of NATO to Kiev, that had sent the director of the CIA to Kiev, that had sent the Secretary of State to Kiev not once but twice, all and publicly to declare the unity of the United States with the acting government of Kiev, now condemned Vladimir Putin for going into Crimea this past week. How is it that we are unable to see the hypocrisy in that? Glenn, I know you're still with us and listening. Didn't it just make your skin crawl when you heard so many Americans saying how provocative, how inappropriate Putin's visit to Crimea was? And yet, look what we did in Kiev.
Oh, yeah. The hypocrisy is stunning. I'm not convinced that there are necessarily any good guy situation. We're stuck with lesser evil choices. Actually, I wanted to point out before the break, there is, relative to this whole Ukraine thing, there is a prominent make the rounds, Patriot Radio pundit and theoristic commentator who is asserting that at the time of the fall of Yanukovych in Ukraine, the only ones who could have made the police and the military stand down so as to allow the overthrow was the Russians, and that this whole thing is part of Putin's plan to reform the Soviet Union, dominated by Russia, and that, this is the case where he's playing, it is he who is conducting a Hegelian dialect in all this, and it is he that is there. And there are several people who are now doing this, and I spoke of them, the West, trying Putin in the court of public opinion and with media propaganda. It seems to me that this also ties in. Alleging that the whole thing, I mean, I agree with, the version you articulated, which is essentially the conventional wisdom.
America was the provocateur. Putin gets credit for a lot of things by conspiracy advocates. So, for example, when that Malaysian plane disappeared, the primary conspiracy theory was that it was Putin that had remote controlled it and was going to somehow use it. The very notion that Putin would have tried to resolve the problem in the Ukraine by offering them $15 billion in loan guarantees and financial support, the very fact that he, each time the Ukraine welched on a deal relative to the gas pipeline over 20 years, 8 times, that he found common ground and didn't intervene in Ukrainian politics, tells me that that's a pretty good-sized stretch. So all of this leads to those in the Luhansk region of the former USSR and prior to that Tsarist Russia wanting to disassociate from this dysfunctional Kiev interim government and to rejoin Russia. The vote occurred earlier this week, and the numbers were very similar to Crimea, which is surprising in a way. 96% of the population voted to separate, to call their country Luhansk as opposed to the Ukraine. And the reason that's surprising is that, in Crimea, 75-80% of the population was ethnic Russian. But in Luhansk, you can believe the polls that are, the numbers that are put out principally by the CIA. The CIA has a page, a listing of every country in the world. If you want to know what percentage of the population is various religions, they want to know their economic history. The CIA has their World Factbook. And according to the World Factbook, if you look at the eastern region of the Ukraine, Luhansk, it's about 40 to 45% ethnic Russian. So to get a 96% vote in favor of separating from the Ukraine, this is not just ethnic Russians. This is not just Russian speakers. Those who really have a stake in the game want nothing to do with the puppets in the Ukraine. So now what? I mean, they're going to have another referendum. And this next referendum is going to be just like the one in Crimea. It's going to say, all right, now that we're independent, do you want to try to form an independent country, recognizing that, that's probably not going to work, or do you want to be reintegrated into Russia and the Russian Federation? And the high likelihood is they're going to choose the Russian Federation. Then what? So, Glenn, you say that there's advocates for a theory that Putin was pulling the strings from the very beginning and that Putin manipulated this outcome, making the sleepy-eyed Putin the most brilliant international strategist of all time.
Oh, yeah. I'm aware there's one heavy hitter in the Patriot realm who's advocating this and several lesser-known people. And it just seems to me that, they're functioning so as to be part of the you know, the system that would try him, you know, through propaganda. Yeah. Right. And it just seems quite silly.
Yeah, that's, I would agree. And if I listen to the proclamations by John McClown of the senator from Arizona, it's all designed to provoke a guttural response. It's the kind of propaganda that America has deployed against its foes, real and imagined. And when we do this kind of thing, it puts us in a war footing. I'll give you another example of a person we vilified, Saddam Hussein. Now, I don't want to pretend that Saddam Hussein was a good guy, but we took Saddam Hussein's gassing of the Kurds to make it a crime against humanity as to which this guy was so villainous that he had to be deposed. Now, the fact is he used American gas to gas the Kurds, and when he gassed that village, it wasn't a terrorist act. It was a survival mechanism. It was at war with Iran. And while there was a stalemate in that war, with both sides losing badly, the Iranians came up with a strategy that finally prevailed and broke the stalemate, which was to arm the Kurds inside of Iraq so that the Kurds inside of Iraq were fighting on behalf of the Iranians against Iraq, and they were turning the tide of that war. And the rebellion of the Kurds in this armed conflict was in the region that Saddam Hussein gassed, and he only gassed it once he was unable to repel the internal rebellion with conventional means. And from that we made a monster.
Well, yeah, and again, our hypocrisy is stunning. Whether it's Saddam Hussein or whether it's now Assad with chlorine barrel bombs. We are the ones that have level 4 and 5 biolabs cranking out monstrosities that could create extinction level events.
We
are. And these guys are using localized gases to kill a few hundred people.
Yeah, and in the case of Iraq, we supplied the chemical weapons. We wanted those chemical weapons deployed against the Iranians, because while the Iranians had been our allies, they were now our foes because of our own stupidity. And as a direct result of that, we wanted to get back at them. So we created the proxy war.